Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. And you know what we do. We're bringing in people who are doing amazing things, long histories, telling their stories, sharing their experiences. And today we have the pleasure of having comedian, host, multiple Grammy nominations and wins, best-selling author. I feel like we could go on for a while. He rants. Mr. Lewis Black joins us. How are you, sir?
I'm good. All things considered, good.
I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule.
Well, that's, it's my life is devoted to taking time out of my schedule. So and I'm glad to be able to spend some time talking to Philadelphia. And especially since my team almost beat you, my Washington Commanders.
Stop it. They play us tough.
No, don't say almost. We came back, look, my team sucked last week, so give me a moment, all right? You guys are doing really well. We're not a threat. I'm just being a little bright and upbeat. I'm trying to find an upbeat moment before I go off.
Before we got started, I will give you that. I've learned my lesson. I've had a lot of comedians on back-to-back weeks and people who come on, and I have learned quickly you don't get into a back and forth with people who do it for a living. Like, you lose that confrontation in a lot of circumstances. So before we got started, you told me that you're just getting back. You're on tour right now, moving around different places. Where are you just coming back from?
I just came back from Las Vegas and it was Las Vegas and California.
And now you're going all over the place. You'll be in our area. We'll get all the dates up on the screen, but Reading, Bensalem, Wilmington, you're going internationally. So very clearly, you still love doing this.
I do. I still I love it. It's become a little tougher because the things that made it really enjoyable was you go into a town and you could park your tour bus in the town. It's harder and harder to park the tour bus there. So you like just last week, we were parked outside of, Boise, Idaho. And Boise's a great city. And so now we're in a place that's just, it's outside. It's 10 minutes out of Boise. So we're at a mall. I could be anywhere. The whole idea of touring is where you're at. It's not like you park in a mall, you could literally show the picture and have people guess and they'd never figure out where you were. There's 12 million places in the United States that look like that. Even though they say malls are dying.
You really love that, the touring, the onstage part, but you like the whole atmosphere, the interacting with people, the being in the city.
Yeah, I mean, that was the joy of it was, you get that opportunity to wander around and see what's going on there, as opposed to flying in, driving to the city, doing the show and driving out. You got no idea.
So why is it just the safety factor? Is the travel factor? Why can't you do that anymore?
Well, it's because cities are saying, you can't bring the bus in because of parking. Just that part of that. You used to be able to park in front of a theater. I've been in, it started last year, and it's there are less places you can take the bus into, or you can't park near the theater. So it becomes, everything becomes just, it's a little more, than what it was before. But the not being able to spend time in the town is really, it just irksome.
That's interesting. I thought there was more to it. It really is the cities who are just saying, "Nah, we can't have that going on our streets."
Well, the city or it has to do with driving and all of that, and whatever they've decided to do this. I really don't know, because for us it's just we're in and then we're out. It's it's these the bigger tours where you've got like a band, or you got two trailers, you got a whole bunch of stuff, then I can understand it. But it's just five schmucks in a bus and a merch trailer.
Right. Let us live. Let us come in and be a part of the city. You've been doing this, obviously, for a minute, a storied career. Take us back a little bit, because I was reading some of your background as how you even got into this. So you've kind of done the whole theater, the background, the comedy thing, going back to like 12 years old.
Yeah. Going back to 12, I was just, about to be bar mitzvahed almost. So, and I thought that might be the gig, because you could actually stand up in front of a group of people and, you know, and tell them whatever you wanted to until they threw you out of the temple. But then I kind of switched out of that. I became interested in theater back then, because my father, when I was about 13 or 14, I started going to the theater with my dad, and I was seeing 6-8 plays a week, a year, a week, idiot. And you'd see eight shows and over the course of the year. And these were like, at the time, and this is going back, you know, remarkable shows like the original Hello Dolly Carol Channing. So, I was seeing first run shows before they were going to Broadway. So I got suckered into it. I thought it was incredible. I got fascinated by theater. It was kind of like I'd never seen anything. It's like something it's magic. Mm-hmm. It really is. A whole group of people wander into a space. There's a whole group of people there and who are going to perform. And together you create a reality. It's literally almost like a drug. So that's probably what drew me to it.
And you got into that, you know, and I guess along with the comedy, before comedy, kind of coinciding with the comedy, hundreds of shows that you were associated with in some capacity. When did it kind of transition to, I'm going to do the comedy thing. I'm going to make my name as the guy who will say what other people are afraid to say.
Well, I was writing plays. I was involved in theater until I was 40. So I did it for 20 years. I wrote a ton of plays. But the thing, and I ran a room with a number of other guys here in New York, which was called the West Bank Cafe Downstairs Theater Bar. It was upstairs a restaurant, downstairs we had a nice, what would be called a cabaret space, but essentially a nice little stage, 100 seats, and most importantly, a bar. And we were able to perform there and do really a whole ton of plays, and I introduced everything. So, and I had been doing stand-up on the side for fun. It was not anything I thought I'd be doing, because it was a way in which I could write something and get it out there. So it was, you know, if I had some thoughts, whatever it was, and I would do these kind of free shows for my friends. And but I wasn't planning on doing it. And then I was on stage kind of introducing these plays and talking about theater or the group that was coming in or whatever, and I had 5 minutes at a time doing this, and did it for a while. And that became something that people who were coming to the shows, a couple of them who ran comedy clubs, said, you know, you really ought to come over here and work. And that was eventually what happened. And then I had a play done in Houston, Texas, and it was a horrific experience. It was a musical that me and my friend who ran the theater, we wrote it. He did the music and lyrics. I did the book. The guy who was the director was also involved with that theater. And we took it down to Houston. It was a horrible experience. It was just awful. And this is what I'd been aspiring to. Now I finally get there. And it's like AAA ball, right? You know, you're not playing for the Phillies, but you're down at the farm team and you're almost in the majors. And it was an awful. And I said, I've been aspiring to do this. No, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. These people are nuts. It's like an abusive orphanage theater. So I went across town to audition for a comedy club there. And then I did 15 minutes. They immediately offered me work. Somebody had dropped out. They offered me the same amount of money I was making for a play that I spent 2 years working on. They gave me a nicer place to stay than the theater had, and they gave me a car. And this is years ago. And I just went, that's it. I mean,
and the rest is history, right?
And the rest was me just wandering around learning to figure out how I was going to do stand up.
Forget this play stuff. I can't make as much money in 15 minutes. And I get to just go on stage and be me.
Yeah. And be me. And also it was really, I was broke, you know, I didn't care. Until that moment, I didn't care about being broke. I had just enough money to get by without health insurance. So I was like, everything was okay. I had no money in the bank, but I was like, you know, I loved doing what I was doing. But finally I went, you know, I gotta be able to survive.
I gotta eat. So was it then you kind of transitioned? You've always been on stage. You've always been kind of starting off the different shows. Was there a period of time where it kind of the Lewis Black who you are now and known for and taking on the issues and the rants and I don't care what you think, was that you that just came on stage, or did that person kind of evolve, that comfort level evolve?
Oh, that evolved, because yelling on stage was not something I thought, you know, people were really ready. You know, I literally, when I started yelling on stage, would turn my back to the audience and yell at the wall, because I didn't want to yell directly at them. And I was doing it a little. And then finally, a friend of mine, another comic, was watching me one night, and he said, you know, I'm on stage yelling the whole time and have nothing really that I should be yelling about. You know, there's no reason I should be yelling. You're the one who should be yelling. So when you go on stage, I want you to just, you know, let it rip and just yell and just, you know, get out the feelings you have, you know, get the anger out, the frustration. And I did. And I went, well, and they went, and the audience loved it. And also it keyed me into, as many comics, it takes a long time to get keyed into what it is that makes you funny, because what makes you funny is fairly personal. If they reject that, they reject you. Mm-hmm. Well, my anger and frustration is what made people laugh. And so all of a sudden I went, oh, there's the key, you idiot. And it was something I knew all along, but being sitting around with your friends and being on stage are two different things.
So you were surprised that the whole ranting, I'm pissed off about this and I'm going to go on stage and say it. Even you were surprised that was successful.
Yeah, I was. I just was amazed. But I was surprised it was successful, but I wasn't surprised because that's the way I'm funny. So, if that hadn't worked, then chances are I'd be teaching theater right now in Philadelphia, if the price was right.
Yeah, right. And they'd let you park your bus somewhere near here. Go ahead and roll with that. You know, it's interesting because it has been and continues to be a career of just being you. But watching the situation, the stage, I would imagine, change, like ranting and taking on the issues, that's less comfortable today, isn't it? Like more and more people are being challenged for taking on the issues and you go headlong into it.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I also pick things that I try to, I think that we, you know, I try to get both sides of that issue out, or certain things I just go, no, enough's enough. I'm an adult. I've lived through a certain amount of time. I've seen what the hell goes on in this country, and certain things I'm not going to tolerate. We went through it. We're not going back. We're not doing that again. We did it. Okay. Decided, we move on. If you idiots want to live in the 20th century, be my guest, go for it. But there's certain things that's just, this is the end of it. We have to have adults in the room. So it's not tough. I basically try, and I try to be humane about it. And if the audience gets upset, you know, part of the time, I mean, I had to deal with it a fair amount before the pandemic. It started to become more of a kind of a reaction, because there are people on the left, the ones that they call woke, which is a stupid word. It's just a stupid word. You know, most of us aren't even awake, let alone woke. So, you know, so you've got those on the left, you got those on the right, and they shut up. They're humorless. They have no sense that the joke is here and then it's gone and it's not going to come back and bite you. Okay? It went away. Don't worry about it. And so I kind of, I had a blowback and I dealt with it initially from the audience. And no one is kind of, you'll get it. I'll get it on Twitter. It's like, this is nonsense. Okay? It's what I'm an idiot wandering around. It's like the only thing separating me from what I'm doing and being a clown is a red nose. Get a grip, people. Get a grip.
Has it changed you at all? I was watching one of your shows actually before I came in here, and it went back a little ways. But you came out and you said, listen, by the time I get finished talking, somebody's going to be offended, and set it up as if you were about to apologize to people. And then when, if you are, that's on you. You had ample opportunity to not come. So you just embrace it.
I mean, that was after the pandemic, and I finally just said, we're not playing this game anymore. You came to the theater and you paid for the ticket and you had a halt, but you don't take your kids to the movies without looking, reading the review. Okay. You don't sit with your kids and go, oh boy, maybe I should have read the review. I didn't know they killed everybody. So you take 5 minutes out to look to see who it is you're going to go see as a comedian, especially now. It's ludicrous and it's tiresome. And even if, you came in and you had a certain expectation and the comedian crossed the line, here's what you do. You shut up. Okay. Just shut up. People in that room, it's a show. And the people in that room came to see the show and they paid good money, probably overpaid.
So we as a society have gone too far with this squeezing what people are allowed, not people, comedians are allowed to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like comedians are out there with this, it's like they'll get upset with something Chris Rock will say or something Chappelle or any number of comics will say. And you kind of go, wow, guys, this hasn't really no effect on anyone. And if what they said was so terrible, why are you repeating it? Okay. If it ends up on a special, even then, okay, it's out there. There's no need for you to repeat it. Other people will see it. They'll come to a judgment on it. Unless it's totally out of control, all right? If it's completely homophobic or it's completely sexist or it's completely, we can go through the list of things. Then you're going to yell about it, okay? And there'll still be an argument. And part of the times that there's the argument is because the joke doesn't work for some people.
Is it new? Because you've been doing this long enough to have experience. Was there a period of time where we got to the point where we started trying to silence the joke? Or has that always been waters you had to navigate?
No, you never had to navigate. I mean, you people get upset, But a lot of that was already cleared. The brush was cleared by George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor. There were all sorts of people along the way that spoke to adults. It's adults in the room being entertained. And some of them are crybabies. Who knew? You used to be able to do it. There was some blowback but not like on the level we went through recently. No. But a lot of that too had to do, it had to do with, now it's just, I can't even go into it. And I just can't even go. I'm screaming in 2 seconds.
Well, excuse me. And I laugh. So off the rails, the tour that you're on right now, but I'm looking at some of the things and looking at your bio on your own page, like he is willing to take on history, politics, religion, culture. And I'm sitting here going, all things that we're trying to silence right now. So when we check out your show and you'll be in our area, again, dates up on the screen, what are we going to see on the Off the Rails tour?
Just some happy comedies.
Of course. Happy
some
talk.
Snappy patter. I like to do some show tunes. That always gets, I end by singing Tomorrow from Annie. No, I'm developing what will be my probably final special, I think. We'll see. I'm working on it now, and it seems to be a good place to kind of wrap things up, which is, you know, how do you satirize what's already satiric? I mean, some of the stuff that's happening is, I think, is funny. The audience is upset by it. Both sides are upset by it. And I'm sorry. Some of it is just is funny. Banning books. It's not funny, but if you read in a book, not in a headline, but in a book, that they were banning the reading of chunks of Romeo and Juliet, and you weren't letting the kids read Romeo and Juliet in its entirety anymore, because you thought it was too much sex in it. Guess what you are? You're clinically insane. Okay? That's what you are. That's the definition of clinical insanity. World's greatest playwright ever. You know? And no kids finish this and go, oh boy, I can't wait to start humping everything. Nobody does that. No one. Anywhere. Okay? Not one child. They can barely get through a sentence and understand it. And you idiots, what, you know, now you're going to attract them to it. What a bunch of jackasses. And that's funny. When you ban Shakespeare, that's funny. That, and if you read it in a book, you'd be laughing. The fact that it's out there, it irritates people, and rightfully so. And then some people, then the group that's banning the book. This is the kind of stuff I'm talking about on stage. This will drive some people. People are going to go, I'm not going to go watch that. Well, don't. I don't have time anymore. It's banning. It's not only that. The group that's trying to ban the book in many places is called Moms for Liberty. Okay? They're banning books, and they're called Moms for Liberty. I don't know how to make a better joke. Okay? It's Moms for Freedom. We're going to ban a book. What? Seriously?
I feel like your conversation with you and your show is every family sitting around at the cookout or whatever, or at the restaurant, and you've had one or two, and people start ranting. Yeah. and you've taken it to the stage. I think what is interesting about it, though, is some of that stuff you're talking about would be hilarious, and it makes you laugh if it wasn't so real. And I think that's part of what makes you go, wow, this is actually happening.
Yeah. And it would be, but the part of what I've begun to feel is if you don't laugh at it, if you don't have the ability to laugh at idiots, to put them in their place, you can't take seriously jackasses. Okay. These people are being as dumb as posts, and you kind of got to laugh at them in order to take the stuffing out of them. There's a 1954 expression. God.
All right. I'm pulling together my professionalism because time is flying as we go through this discussion, and I appreciate it. You're taking your show, as I was reading about the tour, after you get finished kind of touring around, you're also going back internationally and continuing that discussion and your tour overseas and have continued to do that. Is it different? You know, people overseas, like they have the concept of what's stupid, you know, what's ridiculous, seems very different when you travel internationally.
Well, I mean, part of the thing is they literally watch us, and most Americans who've not traveled don't know this. They watch us like it's a Netflix show. It's like being streamed. We are streamed into their homes, and the lunacy of what we do. Just they sit there and go, are you kidding me? And it's issue after issue after issue. Really, you don't have health care? Nah, why would we have health care? That'd be stupid. Why would we have health care that would allow people to be able to exist without worrying if they got a tumor? It's like, to them, it's appalling. Appalling. And to us, it's like, well, we just got to Obamacare where somebody, if they're taken to the hospital, then only has to have $10 million to pay afterwards as opposed to $30 million. So they get the joke. What makes it great to appear overseas is they already know. They're not taking, they don't take a side, right? They already know that that basically they've heard the setup. I'm providing them with the joke. They don't take a side. They know that this is, you know, they don't bring anything to the table except common sense, something that we lost along the way, about 1967.
You know, we're going to have to start wrapping up. It's amazing how quickly time goes by when you're having these discussions. I think what is, at least for me, what is hopefully encouraging is the fact that you've been able to do these rants and take on these issues and go headfirst into them and have had to pick your battles. But for the most part, people laugh and agree with you and go, wow, that really is stupid. Like, that's encouraging. We just have to get more people in positions of power and leadership to do it rather than just us in the public.
Right, exactly. And we actually need to have people who actually want to lead and who have an ability, which comedians in many ways have more of an ability to speak English than many of the people that get elected. You kind of go, wow, I can't believe what just came out of that person's mouth. It's incomprehensible. You know, it's really, look at this. We got a guy who ran for president, you know, who's in the White House, and people really, when he speaks, nobody can hear him. And people get upset because of that. They don't like him. And then you got the guy he's going to run against, you can hear him, and the people who hear him don't like him. So you've got people who can't hear him, who don't like one guy, and people who can hear the other guy don't like him. It's just, what about somebody who just, you know, talks, you know, and kind of helps us along, as opposed to worrying about whether they're going to get elected again? Please, wake up.
I want to give you a chance before we wrap, because the whole theme of this show is the concept of use your voice for good. It's the theme of the show. But in fairness and in jokes aside, you have an extensive list of charities that you have been involved with, work that you are consistently doing. Everything from autism to the military, cystic fibrosis, Parkinson's. Why is being an advocate and a champion of all those things so important to you?
Because it was truly one of the great gifts of being, you know, somewhat of a celebrity. I have just enough celebrity in my life that it has been fun. And what it gave me the opportunity is being a voice for certain groups. So I'm the chairman of the board of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library, so I can, and they do some really great work in terms of, you know, teaching and helping, you know, and in, especially in terms of creative writing and a variety of things, dealing with banned books. And I've worked with the 52nd Street Project, a mentoring group. All of a sudden I had the opportunity to tell folks, look, here's something you might want to send money to. And, you know, so I got to work with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and the list kind of goes on, because it was really the opportunity to be able to say something and help people. And that really was important to me, because that's the reason we're here is to help each other.
It's interesting. You may have just answered it, but the last question for every guest, again, keeping with the happy talk that we've had for the last half an hour.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
We ask everybody to define what use your voice for good means to you. I'm curious to hear what that means to you.
It means that you use your voice to show people that you care, that you understand, that you are empathetic, and that you find certain behavior at times inexcusable, and whether you like it or not, you be an adult. I mean, we have many of our children are the adults in the situation when it comes to you know, climate change and global warming. They're the ones who are actually, you know, because they're the ones who are threatened by it. So it's really all of those things that I think are important.
I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. In a lot of ways, I'm sitting here talking to you going, I hope at some point in my career I get to the point where I am that free to just go ahead and say what needs to be said, free of any consequences, and just look, it is what it is. If you don't like it, you have the opportunity to change the channel.
Yep, and exactly. And that's really what matters. And it's and again, you know, something that I'm not a big Bible quoter, but this too shall pass. We will come through this. I lived in a period of time when we argued ideas, not realities. And we will get back to that time where we share a reality.
Lewis Black, thank you so much. Appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. Thanks for coming on the
Pulse. If you ever want me back, that was great. I really needed that.
We will absolutely have you back. Guys, thanks so much for listening to today's The Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast with Lewis Black. That one was interesting. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We were joking here in the podcast studio that if I don't give and freak was a person, it would be Lewis Black, who just goes out there, says what he says, feels what he feels, and then it is up to us to deal with it. And I think that we honestly, I respect it. As I said, that is a goal that I think a lot of people aspire towards, saying what we feel needs to be said and just roll with it. So I appreciate him spending that much time with us. I encourage you to hit like, subscribe, whatever it is on your screen. That'll get you notifications every time a new episode of The Pulse comes out. Also, head on over to YouTube and check out some of the past episodes that are also outstanding, if I must say so myself. You can follow me on social media at Bill A. Fox 29. Always eager to hear from you. And I leave you today, as I always do, reminding you, whenever you can, use your voice for good and have a good one.